5. Nasser ad-Din Shah and maintaining a fragile balance, 1848 to 1896. In the second half of the 19th century, Qajar Iran survived as a sovereign state in the face of growing foreign pressures and domestic tensions. It did not break up and was not taken over by a colonial power. The Nasseri era, as it came to be known, was dominated by Nasser ad-Din Shah, reigned 1848 to 1896, who ruled over the country for nearly half a century. It was an era of gradual state consolidation, appeasement of the religious establishment, adjustment to European diplomatic and economic realities, and limited success with domestic reforms. Facing a host of economic problems, the era was marked by sporadic urban riots and popular protests. It also witnessed further material and cultural influences from abroad. A new generation of dissidents came to nurture a sense of despair about the future of their country, but also a resistance to intervention by European powers. A stronger sense of national resolve began to emerge. The government's modernization projects, starting with Amir Kabir's reform program at the outset of Nasser ad-Din Shah's reign, continued piecemeal, although the conservative Qajar elite resisted any substantial changes. There are similarities with what had come about in Meiji Japan, or even in Khedivate Egypt or the Ottoman Tanzimat era. No modern industry of any substance emerged, except perhaps workshops established with European capital to export hand-woven Persian carpets to Europe and America. Roads and communication remained underdeveloped. The modern educated sector constituted a small and largely ineffective part of the elite, and the political structure of the Qajar state remained more or less intact. For the Iranian people, the Nasseri period entailed some changes in their lifestyle. New technologies, such as steamships and the telegraph, emerged, and the consumption of commodities such as tea, tobacco, and sugar, as well as the purchase of European fabrics, became more common. Iranians came to learn more about the world beyond their familiar frontiers. The railroad, that great benchmark of the 19th century economic progress, however, remained an unfulfilled dream, primarily because of Anglo-Russian imperial rivalries, but also because of insufficient capital. The lack of a modern rail and road network, whether a curse or a blessing, left Iran far less open than the rest of the Middle East, such as Egypt, to European capital and colonial projects. The late 19th century also generated new intellectual syntheses and fresh artistic creativity in painting and architecture. Contact with Europe invigorated Iran's artistic and literary potential, without, in most cases, undermining its cultural confidence. The Persian artistic imagination and exquisite craftsmanship survived without being entirely enamored of or bedazzled by the West. On the darker side, the Nasseri era was marked by calamities, earthquakes and drought, devastating outbreaks of cholera and plague, and periods of famine, often beyond the capacity of the government's meager resources. Abject poverty and chronic starvation, in part because of changes in the pattern of agricultural production, and hoarding and interference in the flow of essential food items, became common in the cities and in the countryside. The greater tranquility of a small but powerful landowning elite seldom trickled down to benefit the majority. Rather, wealth discrepancies sharpened social divisions and added to popular discontent. If the first half of the 19th century reconstituted the guarded domains of Iran under the Qajars, the second half was an age of national consolidation through common bonds of deprivation and, later, popular protest. So often, such frustrations manifested in petitions to the Shah, in taking refuge in shrines and royal palaces, and in spontaneous food riots. The final demarcation of Iran's geographic boundaries further distanced Iran from its neighboring ethnic Sunni communities, and hence reinforced Iran's Shi'i identity. At the turn of the 20th century, an average inhabitant of Iran, Ali Iran, as he or she was likely to be identified, was more conscious of a collective Iranian identity than a subject of the Qajar Empire under Fateh Ali Shah, even though he or she had not yet been exposed to the modern ideology of nationalism. The Age of Amir Kabir. Few figures of the Qajar era have left their mark on Iranian historical awareness, as did Mirza Taqi Khan Farahani, 1807 to 1852, better known by his military title Amir Nizam, and briefly as Amir Kabir. He has often been celebrated as the champion of national sovereignty, and his age as one of the missed opportunities on the path of progress. He was portrayed as a martyr who had fallen victim to the court's intrigues, vested interests of the nobility, foreign machinations, and a deep-seated culture of despotism. The heroic aura aside, the reality of Amir Kabir's career is no less illustrative of the domestic and foreign obstacles on the way to the serious program of state modernization. During his brief term of office, 1848 to 1851, as the first chief minister of Nasser ad-Din Shah, he strove to instill a new governmental order, Nazm, one rooted as much in the Persian ideals of good government as informed by 19th-century notions of reforming the state. As a middle-ranking bureaucrat in the Tabriz administration, Amir Kabir first made a name for himself in the mid-1840s as Iran's chief negotiator in the Perso-Ottoman Boundary Commission, where he negotiated the Second Treaty of Erzurum. Eventually concluded in 1847, it placed Perso-Ottoman relations, and especially agreement on pilgrimage traffic between the two countries, on firmer footing. He later served as the secretary of the all-powerful Azerbaijan New Army and helped incorporate it into Iran's traditional forces. In his training as a state comptroller and in his reformist perspective, he was a product of the Abbas Mirza era and a protege of the Ghaem Magam family, to whose household his father served as the chief cook. He shared with Haji Mirza Agassi, to whom he was indebted for patronage and promotion, his humble background. Coming from a village in the Farahan region, Amir Kabir was snubbed by the Qajar elite no less than they had despised Agassi. His aversion to the parasitic Qajar nobility and his desire to win over the young crown prince Nasser ad-Din Mirza in Tabriz also followed after Agassi's path to power. He was more determined than his predecessor to hold the orderly reins of power, and in his plans for reform and his foresight in implementing them. In Tabriz, Mirza Taqi Khan first gained access to Nasser ad-Din Mirza, who was serving as prince governor. The young prince was child of an unhappy arranged union between Muhammad Shah, who held little affection for him, and a powerful and protective mother, Jahan Khanum, later Mahde Alia of the Govanlu branch of the Qajars. She had heavily invested in her son's accession to the throne, although Nasser ad-Din's childhood was one of parental neglect. He was viewed as feeble, unimpressive, and unworthy of the Qajar crown. A capable uncle of his, backed by the Russians, seriously disputed his right to the throne. After Muhammad Shah's death, Mirza Taqi Khan proved indispensable in bringing the young crown prince to the capital and help consolidate his royal power. He was like a father to Nasser ad-Din and a tutor, teaching his pupil how to act as a king, conduct the affairs of the state, and resist demands of his family members and court attendants. He intended to hammer out of the young Shah a modern ruler, assertive, educated, and disciplined, perhaps having in mind Abbas I 3 centuries earlier. To Nasser ad-Din Shah's credit, he opted for Amir Kabir and was prepared, to an extent, to listen and learn. Typical of his age, Amir Kabir saw the military as the way to reorganize the government. His vision of overhauling the state was informed by such state reformers as Peter the Great, who had subdued the all-powerful but unruly Russian nobility, and the Ottoman Mahmud II, who had destroyed the remnants of the Janissary Corps as a prelude to the Ottoman military and administrative reforms. Amir Kabir, who 3 times visited Russia and the Ottoman Empire, witnessed the fruits of these reforms. While in Tabriz, he was also close to the British commercial consul, and as early as 1838, he had shared some of his aspirations for political power with the consul. His idea of ministerial control may well have been patterned after the famed Persian viziers of the past. Amir Kabir's appointment in 1848, at the beginning of Nasser ad-Din's reign, to the triple office of Sadr-e Azam, chief minister, commander-in-chief of the army, Amir-e Kabir, and guardian, At our back, to the young Shah, came across as an unusual monopoly of power. It was visibly comparable to that of the celebrated Persian minister Abu Ali Hassan Tusi Nizam al-Mulch, whose example may have been in Amir Kabir's mind. The young Shah was obliged to grant him emergency powers while the country was in a state of political transition. His control of the Azerbaijan army and the orderly investiture of Nasser ad-Din to the throne made such a choice almost inevitable. By 1848, the Babi movement had reached revolutionary momentum. At the same time, a serious secessionist revolt in Khorasan, led by Muhammad Khan Salar, of the rival Davalu wing of the Qajar tribe, also loomed large. Salar was backed by Turkmen and Kurdish tribes of the northeast, who resisted both the Qajar state's control over Khorasan and virtual exclusion of the Davalu Qajars from positions of power. To restore order, the premier relied on the new army of Azerbaijan. In the 3 years that followed, he further reorganized the Qajars' mostly tribal military resources along the lines of the Azerbaijan Corps. By 1851, the army had crushed both the Babi uprisings and the Khorasan insurrections. Amir Kabir was also aware of the need for steady revenue to pay and equip a modern army. This required a sound fiscal policy and the creation of supporting institutions. The Polytechnic Academy that came to be known as Dar al-Funun, Abode of Skills, the first Western-style educational institution, was in reality a cadet school designed to meet the army's needs for engineering, medical, and artillery officers, as well as interpreters. Late in 1851, shortly after the downfall of its founder, Dar al-Funun started to operate with a handful of European instructors and some 100 pupils, hand-picked mostly from among the sons of middle-ranking military and bureaucratic officials. The instructors consisted of a mix of Austrian, Italian, and French infantry, artillery, and cavalry junior officers, as well as a capable surgeon, a mine engineer, and a military surveyor, and language instructors in French, English, and Russian. Instructors communicated with their students through mostly Iranian-Armenian teaching assistants, who later became part of the teaching staff. The college's building was an early example of Perso-European style, inspired by the design of the British Woolwich Military Academy and improvised by an Iranian engineer who studied there. The launching of a government gazette under the new premier was also a step toward modernization. The Vakaye Eta Fakiye, a chronicle of events, was meant to educate the public about Western advances and to enable the state to communicate with its subjects, especially provincial elites, in accessible and concise language. Here, Amir Kabir's initiative followed in the footsteps of Abbas Mirza's administration and the publication of the first newspaper in Tehran in 1837 under the editorship of Mirza Saleh Shirazi, later a protege of Amir Kabir. Nearly two decades earlier, a press in Tabriz, sponsored by Manacher Khan Mutamad al-Dowleh, the Georgian confidant of Fatali Shah, used Persian movable type of the Naske style as early as 1819 to print a host of books, including a history of the Qajar dynasty and popular works by Muhammad Bagher Majlisi. By the 1830s, other presses in Tehran and elsewhere had begun to produce lithographic publications. Under Amir Kabir, and for more than a decade after him, the Vakaye Eta Fakiye reported government appointments and decrees, court and provincial news, and public announcements. It also offered foreign news, both Western and regional, and printed some of the earliest commercial advertisements. Emphasis on world geography and politics, including the earliest public information on the American continent and the United States government and people, new geographical explorations, and technological inventions and engineering feats opened up a new vista for the Iranian readership. The United States was presented as a young nation successfully liberated from the yoke of English colonialism. In the following decades, Qajar Iran witnessed, if not a printing revolution, at least a steady growth of private printing houses. A considerable number of Persian books published in the Nasseri era included religious texts, works of Shi'i elegy, ethics, poetry, popular tales, and some translations of European novels. Before the turn of the 20th century, newspaper publications inside Iran remained a listless endeavor, firmly controlled by the state. Beyond education and the press, Amir Kabir's modernizing strategy relied on harnessing the influence of foreign powers in the country's internal affairs. This is evident, for instance, in his resistance to British intervention in the Khorasan Revolt, or to Russian demands for a greater say in the affairs of Azerbaijan. His earlier affinity in Tabriz with Colonel James Farrant, who later became the British chargé d'affaires in Tehran in 1848, and with Colonel Justin Scheel, the British envoy who succeeded Farrant, both were British officers of the Indian Army who had been given diplomatic posts, facilitated British support and financing of Nasiruddin's march to the capital and accession to the throne. Once in office as the premier, Amir Kabir did not hesitate to assert his independence. Like his predecessors, he viewed the British as a necessary ally and counterweight to the growing Russian threat. Yet he was careful to reserve Iran's authority over a range of issues, including trade regulations, protege status for Iranian subjects, sovereignty over the Persian Gulf coasts, and the behavior of foreign diplomats at the Persian court. The dignity and sovereignty of the Persian state, he insisted, required that European representatives respect the Qajar crown, but deal exclusively with the premier in all affairs of the state. Reversing Iran's growing trade deficit, export of precious metals under the pretext of trade, and shortage of cash, required the enforcement of a strict monetary policy, an option that was not at Amir Kabir's disposal. Boosting the domestic manufacturing base was a realistic alternative. Expansion of the Tehran Bazaar, including a spacious thoroughfare, the magnificent caravansary Saray-e-Amir, and a complex known as Dar el-Sanayeh, abode of fine arts, devoted to the revival of fine arts and traditional crafts, signalled the premier's interest in reinforcing domestic trade and manufacturing. Finance remained Amir Kabir's greatest concern as he grappled with losses in state revenue, the legacy of the Agassi era, and the rise in expenditures. In addition were the heavy cost of military campaigns, court expenses, pensions for the Qajar nobility, and reform projects, including new building construction. His experience as an army accountant no doubt helped with collecting taxes in arrears and reducing expenditures. Given the near bankruptcy of the state in 1848, a balanced budget proved daunting. Enforcing an austerity regime that cut all salaries and pensions in half across the board was daring but contentious. Reducing the young Shah's pocket money brought constant nagging, and slashing the pensions of the court and divan officials bred serious grudge. With the accession of Nasiruddin Shah, a host of his maternal relatives gained prominence. Some of the paternal uncles of the Shah served as governors and army commanders, but few of his maternal relatives, who were given provincial offices, rendered useful services. Government accountants, mustofis, resisted centralizing measures that limited their monopoly over finances and threatened their hereditary offices. Qajar Iran's decentralized state accounting and the many abuses associated with such a system worked against any modernizing initiative, and Amir Kabir's new appointments only partially strengthened his hand. Bringing some measure of discipline to the divan was a step forward. Likewise, the creation of a new agency, the Government Bureau of Justice, Divan Khane-e Adalat, aimed to bring discipline to the otherwise muddled division between the Mojtahed's civil courts and the government's control of customary law, ORF, which was responsible for the adjudication of criminal cases. The new agency also heard some cases involving foreign nationals and addressed other cases related to religious minorities. Frequent petitions from Jewish, Christian, or Zoroastrian families involved cases in which one of the heirs to a deceased person momentarily converted to Islam and appropriated the share of other survivors. Contrary to the Sharia courts, which routinely ruled in favor of the convert, the Bureau of Justice aimed to prevent such abuses, in part because some non-Muslim subjects involved in foreign trade were affiliated with European embassies. The de facto division of state versus religious courts nevertheless continued to plague the Qajar system after Amir Kabir. The mutual reluctance of the ulama and the government to create a uniform code, such as the Ottoman civil code known as Majalla Aham Adliya, compiled during the Tanzimat era, served as a major obstacle to judicial reform. That Amir Kabir relied on the Shah's goodwill to implement his reform measures ignited, almost from the start, the enmity of the Qajar elite. They viewed him as haughty and monopolizing, and considered his draconian measures an unfair breach of their entitled privileges. His marriage at the age of 42 to the 13-year-old sister of the Shah, which he reluctantly complied at the Shah's behest, generated further envy. In particular, Mahde Alia, 1805 to 1873, loathed Amir Kabir, not only because the premier limited her access to the Shah, but also because of his effort to rein in the Qajar nobility. His anti-corruption measures to abolish the practice of madakhel, as well as bribery and extortion by government agents, and his ban on the practice of taking sanctuary, bast, in holy shrines and in other safe locations by suspects or culprits of crimes, made him even more enemies. Barring many idols and busybodies from access to the Shah, and reducing the salaries and privileges, begrudged many attendants and court functionaries. Close supervision of the Shah's everyday affairs and his whereabouts, even cautioning him against engaging too much pleasure rather than discharging his royal duties, also had a cumulative effect of cooling Nasser ad-Din's affection and eventually his support for the chief minister. Treading a narrow, non-committal path toward either of the two neighbouring empires also caused trouble. Amir Kabir's diplomatic conduct was proper and considerate, but he did not hesitate to assert his independence and, if necessary, voice his opposition. He nurtured a controlled sense of resentment for European emissaries' unjustified interference in Iran's domestic affairs. Without idealizing him beyond his reality, as many nationalist narratives of the 20th century have done, Amir Kabir can be seen as an anti-imperialist with a proto-nationalist vision. He resented the obsessive nitpicking of foreign envoys, who at every turn tried to check him and his policies, even if they were not remotely threatening to the vested interests of their countries. During the Agassi era, when the full effects of the Treaty of Turkmenchay became evident, the neighbouring powers missed no opportunity to embarrass and humiliate the chief minister, the Shah, and the government, and to employ whatever was in their means to display their imperial superiority. Amir Kabir was adamant that he would not budge in the face of the kind of demands and pressures that were sustained by his predecessor. Yet he had to give in to their reasonable demands. He agreed, for instance, at least nominally, to the British request to ban torture. After much resistance, he gave his implicit consent to ban the slave trade in the Persian Gulf as well. Contrary to Agassi's time, seldom under Amir Kabir were there diplomatic crises caused by the Russian or British envoy demanding official satisfaction from the Iranian government for trivial cases. It is undeniable that Amir Kabir had come to power with the British diplomats' financial and moral support. In response, he remained, for a while at least, indebted to them. His dismissal of the French military officers in the Iranian service and the subsequent break in relations with France in order to please the British was one obvious error of judgment. Agassi had nurtured relations with France, despite the condescending attitude of the French representative, so as to balance the pressures from the British side. Friendly gestures toward Britain, although limited, had the additional cost of incensing the Russians. Although after assuming power, Amir Kabir sufficiently distanced himself from the British, and in due course developed genuine differences with them on a range of issues, the Russian envoy in Tehran refused to label him anything other than pro-British. By late 1851, Amir Kabir's growing isolation and diminishing power base became more apparent. The young Shah, under pressure from his mother and her allies in the conspiring court, and among ranking officials, turned increasingly fearful of his chief minister and guardian. He dismissed Amir Kabir from office in December 1851, a decision that proved to have grave consequences. Fearing for his life, a fate similar to Ghaem Magam's 15 years earlier, Amir Kabir first sought some form of security from the Shah, and later, when disappointed, from other quarters. Yet neither his plea for protection from the British envoy in Tehran, which was quietly denied, nor an offer of protection from the Russian legation in Tehran proved effective. Diplomatic involvement only added to the Shah's suspicions and gave Amir Kabir's enemies a perfect excuse to conspire for his destruction. He subsequently was banished to Kashan, where he briefly stayed under house arrest in the nearby royal garden in Fien. Soon after, in January 1852, the Shah dispatched a court confidant to Kashan with the secret mission of murdering Amir Kabir. While he was in a bathhouse in the Fien garden, the executioners arrived. They cut his wrists open and let him bleed to death. As some observers noted, even in his own time, Amir Kabir was an exceptionally capable, though autocratic, statesman in the mould of the 19th-century modernisers. His vision of reform was top-down, functional, and clearly designed to create a disciplined and orderly regime. He was inspired by the European ideas of material progress, by industrialization under the shield of a militarized state. Naturally, such a vision could not tolerate an indigenous movement of religious reform, such as that of the Babis, which was rooted in messianic aspirations and seeking finality to the unresolved Shi'i problem of authority. Clashes between the two visions were inevitable. Yet, as it turned out, they both succumbed to the conservative Qajar rule that soon prevailed and endured in one way or another until the end of the 19th century. Obstacles to reform. The fall of Amir Kabir illustrated many obstacles in the way of state modernization. Above all, there was a clear shortage of financial and human resources. The state-enforced initiative envisioned by Amir Kabir lacked an independent base of power. His anti-corruption agenda and his resolute conduct also deprived him of a network of allies and exposed him to the onslaughts of the Qajar nobility. It was another painful demonstration of the Divan's inherent inability to free itself of the hegemony of the Shah and his court. The Qajar establishment viewed Amir Kabir as a necessary tool and tolerated him insofar as he could return security to the land, prevail over the Babis and the Salar revolt in Khorasan, and bring about a semblance of order. Once these tasks were reasonably accomplished, the Qajar elite was ready to remove him from office, as in the past they had eliminated other slaves of the sublime shadow of God. The formidable task Amir Kabir faced can best be measured by the state's income and expenditures. Iran's total revenue for the tax year 1851 to 1852, at the end of Amir Kabir's era, was no more than 3,177,000 tumans, $7,731,000 US dollars, of which 84% was in cash and the rest in grains and other agricultural products. In the late 1840s, Iran's total revenue stood at 2,991,000 tumans, $7,475,000, of which some 60% came from four provinces: Azerbaijan, 20%, Tehran and adjacent provinces of central Iran, 16%, Fars, 13%, and Isfahan, 11%. The remaining 40% was raised from nine other provinces of the realm. This explains how the four major centres of political power in Qajar Iran, Tehran, Tabriz, Isfahan and Shiraz, could maintain a certain degree of autonomy by relying on their own resources. Even after Amir Kabir's financial overhaul, a quarter of the state income, almost 800,000 tumans, $2 million, was still spent on salaries, pensions and divan expenditures, of which 67% was devoted to the ranking officials and to the royal household. Of this latter figure, one-third, that is 8% of state revenue, went to salaries of the Shah and the royal family, 15% to Qajar khans and nobles, at least 20% to the court attendants, servants, royal guards and the royal stable, and about 5% to the chief minister and his office and household. Of the remaining 33.5%, only 3.25% went to the officials and secretaries of the Divan Khane, and 2.85% to poets, physicians, interpreters, and the ulama. The huge discrepancy between the Qajar establishment, which received 66.5% of the salaries, and the Divan, which took only 3.25%, demonstrates the power and privilege of the ruling elite versus the rank and file of the central bureaucracy. In the same tax year of 1851 to 1852, the total of 2,656,601 tumans, $6,640,000, of the state's annual cash revenue, some 12% went to such general expenses as gift-giving, construction, the postal service, and other limited public works, and only 10.9% went to provincial expenses. A staggering 45%, however, went toward upkeep of the military. In early 1852, Iran's armed forces stood, at least on paper, at 137,248 strong, which included 94,570 infantry in 50 regiments, 23,419 cavalry in 12 regiments, 9,927 riflemen, 6,349 artillerymen, working with 1,000 pieces of artillery, and 2,733 rural police. By comparison, in 1849, at the outset of Amir Kabir's term, the Iranian army was 92,724 strong. 67% growth in the size of the military in 3 years presumably was in response to the challenges the Qajar state faced, but also it is indicative of Amir Kabir's desire to build up Iran's defences. The cavalry and most of the infantry were recruited from among the tribes. In the 1850s, of Iran's total population of nearly 5 million, no less than 50% were nomadic or semi-nomadic, 30% were villagers, and some 20%, about 800,000, were urbanites. The tribal population scattered throughout the country made up more than 343,000 tents. The nomads were tallied by number of tents, consisting of 18 tribes and sub-tribes in Azerbaijan, 20% of the tribal population, 19 in Fars, 16%, 27 in Khorasan, 24%, and the remaining 40% in other provinces. There were at least 9 major tribal groups: the Turkish-speaking tribes of Azerbaijan and elsewhere, the Kurds, the Lurs, the Bakhtiardis, the Gashgais, the Arabs, the Baloch, and the Turkmens, as well as tribes throughout Gilan, Mozandaran, and Astarabad. These 4 divisions altogether comprised at least 188 sub-tribes and clans of different sizes, languages, and ethnicities. They were vastly different in their habitats and often barely accessible to central or provincial authorities. Their extraordinary diversity made collection of taxes from them an arduous task, let alone any attempt toward greater centralization. Nevertheless, some form of capitation was collected from the tribes, which applied not only to women and children, but also to animals. The tribal leadership was also obliged to render a seasonal tribute in the form of fighting men in addition to or in place of the taxes. That tribes honoured even such a degree of compliance was a credit to the Qajar state. Taxes on the urban population were set figures, about 10% in most cases, collectible through the bazaar guilds, to whose coffers individual members contributed according to the size of their business. There was also up to a 20% tax on rental properties. The greater burden of the taxes, however, was on the most accessible and the most vulnerable agrarian sector, which made up no more than 30% of the population. Invariably, government tax collectors were responsible for collecting the peasants' share of the taxes directly from them on the location, and often in kind. The rates differed from province to province and ranged between 10% and 20%. The lack of a consistent and updated tax register and the diverse and complex system of land tenure and sharecropping allowed for a range of abuses, often taken for granted. Amir Kabir's short term of office did not allow him to complete his intended reassessment and update of the land survey that had originally been made at the time of Karim Khan Zand some 80 years earlier. His efforts to repossess some of the land tenures, Toyul, and the crown lands that were misappropriated by the high officials in earlier decades, barely contributed to the government's revenue growth. The vast number of estates around the capital, as many as 10,000, that were appropriated under Agassi and eventually brought into the possession of the Divan, seems to have been returned to their owners. Yet even an increase in land taxes by as much as 10% angered the landed nobility. By the time Amir Kabir was deposed, the Qajar establishment was ready to return to the familiar pattern of governance. Old ways and new ambitions. The appointment of a new chief minister, Sadr-e Azam, Mirza Aga Khan Nuri, 1807 to 1865, was a return to the traditional governance of the Fath Ali Shah era. It had every sign of a conservative palace coup aiming to benefit the Qajar nobility and affiliated bureaucratic elite. Beyond the influential Mahde Olia, who was in cahoots with Nuri, the appointment of the new premier also enjoyed the active approval of the British envoy, Colonel Justin Scheel. At the time, Scheel shared with the young and insecure Nasser ad-Din Shah his suspicions of Amir Kabir's Russian leanings. Both sides, therefore, viewed the Anglophile Nuri as the way to block the possibility of Amir Kabir's return to power with Russia's blessing. The course of events further proved the intensity of the European powers' rivalry. Not only did it contribute to Amir Kabir's murder, it also plunged the Shah and his new chief minister into a serious quagmire, most visibly in the disputed province of Herat, which the Qajars had long claimed as an inseparable part of Iranian Khorasan. Nuri was a statesman of some complexity. A great tactician, though lacking strategic foresight and scruples, he was a persuasive negotiator and a skilled manoeuvrer. His gift was in the art of compromise, and he was seasoned by many years of the Divan scheming. His political conduct was conditioned by a mix of self-preservation, hence earlier acquiring the British status of protégé, and his advocacy of the old Qajar values was untouched by the modernizing outlook of his predecessor. His very appearance, he wore a long beard and a longer sheepskin hat, an embroidered silk gown and loose trousers, was reminiscent of the style of Fath Ali Shah's era. His wit and comforting demeanour made him a new fatherly figure to the young Shah, far gentler than Amir Kabir. Yet the tragic fate of his predecessor, a fate for which Nuri was partially responsible, persuaded him not to lose sight of the royal wishes and fickleness. To assert his maturity and independence, the young Shah's rite de passage necessitated not only the destruction of Amir Kabir, his old tutor and guardian, but also reverting to the Qajar dream of territorial conquest and military glory. Capturing Herat province was an obvious objective, even though it was bound to run counter to British wishes. The policy of keeping Afghanistan as a virtual protectorate, a costly great game enterprise, had already taken many British lives. Fearful of Russian advances through Central Asia, the Russophobes in Calcutta and London saw it as a move toward the Persian Gulf and the Indian subcontinent. Lord Palmerston, 1784 to 1865, the British Foreign Secretary and conservative architect of British colonial policy in the early Victorian era, viewed Iran as a weak link, vulnerable to Russian pressure and an obstacle to the British grand strategy to unify Afghanistan. The 1853 agreement between Iran and Britain was an undeniable success for Nuri, who negotiated it with great diplomatic skill. It allowed Iran to interfere in Herat if Britain, or its adventurous Afghan ally, Dost Muhammad Khan, infringed on that province's neutrality. The young Nasser ad-Din Shah saw this diplomatic advantage as a prelude to securing Iranian suzerainty over Herat, what his father and before him his grandfather, Abbas Mirza, had failed to accomplish. London, however, began to have qualms about the agreement and his rapport with the Qajar government began to deteriorate. The Crimean War, 1853 to 1856, offered the Shah and his premier a chance to strike a secret deal with Russia, at war with Britain and its allies, to secure support for the capture of Herat while British attention was diverted to other quarters. Suspicious of Iran's secret deal, London sent a new envoy, Charles Murray, to Tehran to underscore its annoyance with the Iranian government's desire to reassert control over Herat. But the quarrelsome British representative, who from the start was determined to teach the Shah and his minister a lesson, soon found himself in the midst of a scandal caused as much by his own foolhardy conduct as by Nuri's scheme. An utter scandal by diplomatic standards of the Victorian era, Murray was accused not only of having an illicit relationship with a sister-in-law of the Shah, but also of harbouring her and her husband, enemies of the Premier, inside the British legation. The envoy's hard-to-satisfy gentlemanly honour, so closely tied up with the British colonial ethos and prestige, was injured. The resulting break in diplomatic relations between the two countries came as a golden opportunity to the Shah, who almost immediately dispatched troops to Herat. Over the protests of the British authorities, and at the expense of draining the treasury, the Iranian troops captured the city in October 1856, after many months of laying siege against Herat and the seemingly impenetrable walls of its citadel. The conquering prince, Commander Murad Mirza Hossam al-Sultaneh, a valiant uncle of the Shah, even struck a victory coin and ordered the Shi'i call to prayers to be announced from the minarets and the name of the Shah to be included in the Friday sermon in Herat's mosques. Qajar sovereignty over Herat did not last long. Soon, the British Indian fleet appeared at Bushehr with as many as 15,000 British troops and sepoys. By January 1857, British forces had penetrated deep into Fars province. Although the tribal militia of Tangistan and Dashtistan in southern Fars put up a stiff resistance and inflicted some casualties on the advancing British, the regular Iranian forces were slaughtered by the enemy in the Battle of Hushab. Fearing further territorial loss, the demoralized Qajar government hastily withdrew from Herat, with no visible accomplishment in exchange for the cessation of all hostilities with Britain and the resumption of protracted peace negotiations. Yet British punitive actions did not end even after a peace treaty was negotiated in March 1857 in Paris. Under General Outram, a commander with many colonial credits under his belt, including humbling the rebellious people of Afghanistan and Sindh, the British fleet reached the head of the Persian Gulf and in late March heavily bombarded the Iranian port of Mahamara, today's Khorramshahr. At the end of the 1857 Paris peace treaty, mediated by the French Emperor Napoleon III, Iran was obligated to renounce any territorial claims over Herat or any other part of Afghanistan. The Paris peace treaty represented a turning point in Iran's relations with Britain, just as the 1828 Turkmenchai treaty did with Russia. The Herat affair made clear to the Qajar state the grave consequences of militarily engaging a European colonial power. The Shah and his government realized that negotiation, brinksmanship, and the politics of balancing the two empires on Iran's opposite borders were the only realistic alternative. In the age of empires, it became painfully apparent that Iran would have to accept the loss of territory on its periphery for the sake of preserving its center. The loss of Herat, like the Caucasian provinces earlier, demonstrated the limits of sovereignty over regions that historically and culturally were parts of Greater Iran, but could no longer remain provinces of the guarded domains. 4 years later, another loss of a nominal vassalage, the city of Marv and the surrounding province of Iran's northeast, further proved the inevitability of abandoning the difficult-to-control frontier lands. The continued Turkmen raids in northern Khorasan and the abduction of thousands of Iranian captives further blemished the image of the Qajar crown. In 1861, a campaign against the Teke Confederacy was poorly organized and badly executed, ending disastrously with many casualties and troops falling into Turkmen captivity. By 1862, it was reported, the price of Persian slaves in the Bukhara market dropped to as low as 5 English shillings. Discontent and half-hearted remedies. By the early 1860s, Iran began to experience new forms of popular unrest. Recurring famine and devastating outbreaks of cholera, which continued well into the 20th century, became familiar features of the Iranian social landscape. The state's failure to effectively deal with these calamities lowered its prestige among its subjects, as did shifts in the economy. Riots in the capital and in the provinces, and a string of real or suspected assassination attempts, resulted in the government's repeated punitive actions, but to no avail. Violence toward urban and rural subjects visibly increased, putting the government on the defensive. Cruel practices, such as bodily mutilation, subsided in number, except in the case of such heretics as the Babis and later the Baha'is. Yet there were enough punitive actions still in place to intimidate the public. The widely used Dag Vár Deravsh, branding and piercing, carried out by the court's chief discipliner, Nasag Shi Boshi, was a reminder of the centrality of punishment to the Qajar system. It ranged from the most popular bastinado, falak, to more violent modes of torture, imprisonment, and execution. That even the ranking state officials were not entirely immune from bastinado, at times by instantaneous order of the Shah or a prince governor, pointed to the egalitarian nature of the practice, a symbolic display of royal control over the fate of servants and subjects at large. Bread riots were a common feature of urban life, with greater regularity from the mid-1850s onwards. They were in part caused by the landowners and government officials who hoarded their grain to bring about a price hike and so maximize their profits. Poor interprovincial communication was another cause. Moving toward a market economy and the production of cash crops, such as tobacco and opium, also affected grain production. Occasional tax relief lightened the burden of the peasants in famine-stricken regions, but taxes were often recouped by a heavy-handed collection in the following year. In the long term, concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny elite, including the landowning notables, Qajar princes, high-ranking officials and tribal khans, meant the impoverishment of the multitudes. The House of Gavam, the family of Mirza Ibrahim Kalantar Shirazi, the fateful first premier of the Qajar era, is but one example of urban elites' ability to endure throughout the Zand, Qajar, and early Pahlavi periods, thanks to large landholdings, control over urban offices, and the administration of tribal confederacies in their provinces. Nuri's regime itself was grounded in amassing wealth. His network of relatives and subordinates drew enormous salaries from the state's coffers. By the late 1850s, his annual salary alone topped 65,000 tumans. It was not without reason that he remained suspicious of, if not entirely opposed to, measures that could improve the government's performance and increase revenue. Contrary to Amir Kabir, he kept the Shah at bay and indulged him with nighttime feasts, hunting, leisure, and a barrage of gifts and flattery. Even the Shah's favourite wife, Jeran Khanum, a dancer of humble origins whose meteoric rise inside the royal harem caused much envy, fell short of derailing Nuri. Yet the premier's old-school politicking was bound to run aground as the Shah, then more financially astute, came to realise the enormous cost of Nuri's administration. The Nizamiya mansion Nuri had built for his family was the most ostentatious symbol of his wealth. By 1858, after 7 years serving as Sadr-e-Azam, the Nuri era came to an abrupt end. Not unlike Amir Kabir, he was dismissed and exiled to the Iranian interior, from which he never returned. Humiliated and broke, in 1865 he died under suspicious circumstances, clearly arranged by his enemies and with the Shah's consent. Nuri's dismissal brought to an end the prime ministerial epoch that had been in place since the 1800s. Even if chief ministers were frequently dismissed and occasionally destroyed, the office itself survived apart from the court. Direct rule, the Shah's taking on of government responsibilities, removed even partial ministerial autonomy, at least for the time being. It also promised a more efficient government, a desperate move, no doubt, to break through the chief minister's monopoly. In the long term, direct rule resulted in a haphazard system of petty bickering between the conservative and reformist factions of the government. It also ransomed off the government to the whims of a capricious but shrewd ruler. He organised new ministries and created a cabinet of ministers under his direct supervision. Shortly afterward, he also convened a consultative council, whose members were mostly from among the officials and elites, with a few progressives in their midst. Yet once the council embarked on even minor municipal reforms, these were sufficient to raise the Shah's innate suspicion toward delegation of power. Within a year, the council became almost defunct. The same pattern would repeat itself many times in later years. In introducing reform measures, the Shah for a while was inspired by the French model under Napoleon III and his project of reconstituting an authoritarian imperial regime. Among Iranian advocates of reforms was the celebrated Mirza Malcolm Khan, 1833-1908, a young French-educated diplomat, teacher and political essayist who was close to the Shah. An Armenian from New Julfar who converted to Islam, he had witnessed the 1848 revolution and the Paris Commune. After his return to Iran, he was discovered by Nouri and included in the Iranian mission to the Paris peace negotiations. His political essays, written in simple Persian prose and mostly circulated anonymously and in manuscript form, sought a model of state reform compliant with the Qajar establishment's conservative view of government. His Essay from the Invisible, Ketab Cheye Gaybi, written circa 1858, promoted a model of government not dissimilar from that of the Ottoman Tanzimat, which had been reaffirmed by the Sultan's 1856 imperial rescript, but also inspired by Russian constitutional absolutism and the French Second Republic. His Orderly Absolute Monarchy called for a constitutional government based on enforcement of the law, Qanun, and a legislative council, Majlis, whose members were to be appointed by the Shah. Most of Malcolm's proposed constitution concerned administrative and state affairs and steered clear of the domain of the Sharia. The Shah was recognized as the ultimate source of all decisions, but the legislative task of the council was clearly distinguished from the executive power of the cabinet. The latter consisted of ministers appointed by the Shah for education, justice, war, foreign affairs, and other departments. Malcolm's call for the urgent undertaking of state reforms was closely tied in his essay to the danger of Europe's colonial expansion and how Iran should withstand it. In a dramatic tone, he urged the chief minister, to whom he addressed his essay, "Put the map of Asia in front of yourself and read the history of the past 100 years, and examine carefully the course of the two bursting deluges that were propelled in the direction of Iran from Calcutta, the first administrative capital of British India, and St. Petersburg, and see how these two streams, which in the beginning were not noticeable, in a short time became so great. You can then see two deluges that from one side reached Tabriz and Astarabad, and from the other entered Herat and Sistan. Then you can tell how many minutes remain in the life of this state." Malcolm's cautionary words were among the earliest conceptual expressions in Persian political literature of Europe's imperial threat. It is doubtful that the newly appointed council ever considered such a caution or took into account Malcolm's recommendations, let alone implement them. Shortly after Malcolm Khan produced his early treatises, he also formed a semi-clandestine society around 1861 in Tehran to further his reformist agenda. The Faramush Khaneh, House of Oblivion, presumably modelled after Masonic lodges, and vocally sounded like the word Freemasonry, was the earliest modern political association independent of the state. As in his Essay from the Invisible, here too Malcolm relied on the familiar Persian notion of secret society to further his political agenda. The society was headed by the progressive prince Jalal ad-Din Mirza, a son of Fath Ali Shah, and later the author of the first modern history textbook in a pure Persian prose, devoid of Arabic words and with a nationalist overtone. The society included a handful of literary figures, poets, historians, liberal clergy, and a number of Babi affiliates and freethinkers. Though little is known about the society's activities, thanks to the Qajar state's effective eradication of most evidence, it must have been significant enough to draw the hostility of conservative elements within the court, who managed to invoke the Shah's gravest suspicions. As quickly as Nasser ad-Din Shah forgot about the council, he also lost interest in Malcolm and his initiative to create a semblance of a political party. Retracting his earlier reform measures, in what could only be called a military coup, in 1864, the Shah appointed a conservative Qajar army officer, the head of the Royal Guards, as commander-in-chief of the army and granted him extensive civilian responsibilities. Soon a royal decree banning the Faramush Khaneh was followed by raids on the society's headquarters, arresting some, intimidating others, and driving into exile the most vociferous among the members. Some may also have been murdered. Malcolm himself, along with his father, Yagub Khan, who served as Persian secretary of the Russian mission in Tehran, was allowed to take refuge in the Ottoman capital. Alleged subversive activities were the official cause for the clampdown, even though the society's debates, insofar as we know, barely went beyond Malcolm's proposed programme of orderly constitutionalism. Even debating such issues as civil liberties was sufficiently threatening to the Shah and the conservative elite to bring about the closure of the clandestine Faramush Khane, let alone an alleged call for republicanism. With its closure, all hopes for political reforms were dashed for at least another decade. The conservative camp, whose advocates viewed any measure of political modernization as a conspiracy to destroy their vested interests, prevailed, and in the coming years the Shah and his government opted for minimum and mostly cosmetic changes in the organization of the state.